This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before the war in the Balkans, when most of us weren't paying attention to that part of the world, journalist Robert Kaplan was warning about the coming crisis. His new book, Balkan Ghosts, is a political travel book that helps explain the history and the hatreds behind today's fighting. The book is based on the 7 years he lived in Greece, during which he traveled through Yugoslavia, Albania, Romania, and Bulgaria. His previous book, Soldiers of God, was about his travels in Afghanistan with the Mujahideen, the Muslim guerrillas who resisted the Soviet invasion. Kaplan is a contributing editor for The Atlantic magazine and has written for The New Republic. Right now he lives in Washington, D.C. He says that throughout the 80s, he tried to interest editors and the general public in the Balkans' brewing crisis, but he had little success.
Because it's been about 4 or 5 generations worth of policymakers and journalists since the last time the Balkans was front page. Remember, even in World War I and World War II, when there were massive battles being fought in the Balkans, there were even bigger battles on the Western Front, on the German-Russian frontier. So even in the 2 world wars, even though the Balkans started World War I, the Balkans was still more or less a sideshow. So the Balkans became, psychologically speaking, a sort of like metaphor for obscurantism. So it became like psychologically impossible for people to conceive of a situation where the Balkans would be number one in the world.
So what was it like for you to be reporting from a part of the world that many saw as too confusing and inconsequential?
It was eerie. I lived in Greece for 7 years, and I made my living going back and forth to Afghanistan, to the Horn of Africa, and all over the Middle East. My hobby and my obsession became the Balkans, and I would go back and forth to Zagreb, but back and forth to Bosnia, back and forth to Belgrade, and also to the other capitals. And I was frequently, if not always, the only journalist in town. I would have the whole place to myself. And what I quickly realized was that beneath the carapace of communism, there was just a place just riven, boiling with ethnic tensions. And once the lid of communism came off or started to unravel, which was apparent before 1989, actually, in 1988, it became, you know, it was an easy conceptual jump to realize that once communism was over, all this would break out again. The day the Berlin Wall fell, I was in Kosovo reporting on a riot between Serbs and Albanians. I was the only American journalist there, and only one of 5 or 6 journalists there. The others were all local Yugoslav reporters. And I remember my editor telling me, you know, Europe's coming together. You know, what are you reporting about this? And in fact, it inspired me to write a piece that was on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal Europe in November 1989, only 2 weeks after the wall fell, saying that Europe was not coming together. It was just redividing. Instead of East and West, NATO and Warsaw Pact, there would now be Central Europe and the Balkans. And while Central Europe was something the media knew all about, the Balkans was something the media would discover over the coming years.
So how has it felt for you to now be an expert on the part of the world that is the international obsession?
It's sort of a good, bad feeling. Good in the sense that I've learned to have more confidence in my own judgment and to know that what is likely to happen in a few years is also likely to be something that the conventional pundits will laugh in your face at if you suggest it. It's also been a bad feeling because I've become very fatalistic because you realize that even when you predict something, it doesn't help. If it's fated to play out, it does. I mean, this happened in Iran in the 70s when there was one after another first or second secretary at the embassy who was writing reports about fundamentalism, and nobody wanted to listen to them. This happens all the time, and in fact, I should say that I was not the only one. If you had gone to Belgrade in the mid-80s, one after another Reuters correspondent predicted this. In fact, I remember having a lunch with Reuters correspondent Peter Humphrey in Belgrade in 1988. He had just penned a series of articles explaining why Slobodan Milosevic was going to destabilize Europe in the coming years. At that point, nobody except Peter, I, and a few others even knew who he was.
You know, I think I'm one of the people who's kind of guilty of overlooking the Balkans and other parts of the world, too. And I know why, also. I usually have to be dragged kicking and screaming into understanding a new part of the world because it's so hard.
Yes, it is.
There's just too much. I just cannot digest all the things going on around the world.
Also, the Balkans is not visually friendly to television. Beirut was first-class hotels next to first-class satellite facilities with street fighting right down the street. The Balkans is a bit like Afghanistan. The logistics are harder. Everybody looks the same. The names are all unpronounceable with too many consonants and not enough vowels. It is a region that nobody wants to cover until they're forced to cover. Yugoslavia is so complex ethnically and historically that it resists condensation within the strictures of hard news writing. Meaning by the time a reporter would say that there are six republics and two autonomous provinces and three languages and two alphabets, well, 400 of his 800 words are finished already, and the reader is bored to death.
Well, you say that the drama is in the process in which hatreds build in Yugoslavia. That's a difficult thing to write about, too, isn't it?
It's something that can only be written about by showing it, not by explaining it. You see, the minute you hear about all these ethnic hatreds, the first instinct of a journalist is to condense, to strip away, to capsulize, to pick one or two things and to summarize. But the whole thing about the Balkans is that people have these incredible memories that go back hundreds of years where they remember every single detail. And once you start stripping away the details, you start diluting the memories, and then you find it harder to understand why these people are acting so irrationally.
I think it's hard for Americans, in part because America is a relatively new country, to understand the depth of history in this crisis, the depth of the historical sense of people feeling they were wronged.
America's made an end run around history.
Yeah.
These people have run into history like a brick wall. And they've done that because, well, first it's geographical. Look at it this way. The Balkans is a mountainous region where mountains have separated one people from the other, and therefore the people were always ruled by an outsider. Whether it was Byzantium, Ottoman Turkey, or Tsarist or Communist Russia, there was always an outsider keeping these squabbling peoples more or less at peace. Now we face, for the first time ever, an historically unprecedented situation. There is no outsider willing to insert the necessary amount of force to keep these people at peace. And what each of these peoples long for is to reconstitute their empires at the time of the greatest imperial expansion, meaning that everybody's territorial dreams conflicts with everybody else's.
As you traveled around and you'd meet strangers on the road, you'd try to talk with them about their hatreds, just to kind of get a sense of where that was coming from. Is there a chance you could tell us a couple of stories that would be illuminating for us?
Yes. I'll tell you two. One about a city and another about a man. The city is Zagreb, the capital of Croatia. And when I went there in 1981, in 1985, 1989, the obsession was the same. Everyone wanted to talk about one man whose name I've never seen mentioned in any of the journalists' accounts. His name was Alojza Stepinac, the cardinal and archbishop of Croatia during World War II. The Serbs considered him a war criminal who baptized with one hand and slaughtered with the other. The Croats considered him a national saint, who had in fact saved many Serbs, Jews, and Gypsies. The fact is nobody has yet come to terms with this man's legacy. I found there was no city in Europe where the Holocaust was still so undigested and still so fought over as in Zagreb, the capital of Croatia. This is what everybody wanted to talk about, one man in the 1930s. Another time was I was walking on the road in Romania, and I met this old Jewish man, and all he wanted to talk about was what in Romania is known as the Slaughterhouse Massacre, where in two nights in 1941, in January, 200 Jewish men, women, and children were dragged out of their homes, taken to a municipal slaughterhouse, stripped naked, and put through all the stages of animal slaughter. He took me to the graves of these 200 people. And this event is still fought over between Romanian fascists, Jews, Romanian liberals, all who blame somebody else for it.
Journalist Robert Kaplan is my guest. He lived in Greece for about 7 years. He's traveled for many years throughout the Balkans and has written a new book called Balkan Ghosts. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Robert Kaplan is my guest, contributing editor of The Atlantic and author of the new book, Balkan Ghosts. You attribute some of the ethnic conflict in the former Yugoslavia to the differences between the Western Catholic Church and Eastern Orthodoxy. Why is that such a big deal?
All right. Croatia and Serbia are... Croatia is the most southeasternmost of Western Catholic nations. Serbia is the northwesternmost of Eastern Orthodox nations. In a sense, the difference between Catholics and Orthodox is even greater than the difference between Jews and Christians, because Judaism, because of the diaspora, has become a Western religion, as is Protestantism. Jews may consider themselves Jews, but their operating culture in the West is that of Protestant Calvinism. In the Eastern Church, deeds count less than just often going through the motions of ritual. In the East, ritual and magic count for a lot. In the West, deeds and doing good works do. A Western wedding ceremony can take only an hour or so. In the East, it could last for 4 days. They are metaphors for completely different approaches to life. Do not assume that because both the Croats are Christian and the Serbs are Christian that they therefore should be brothers. This is not the case. There, in terms of mentality, there may be more similarities between Eastern Orthodoxy and Islam than there is between Western Christianity and Eastern Christianity, because both Eastern Orthodoxy and Islam are both Eastern religions, rather.
Has Christianity and Islam been at odds with each other in the Balkans historically, or is this relatively new?
Yes, they have been at odds historically, because the Bosnian Muslims, and even more particularly the Albanian and Macedonian Muslims, are the living appendages of four or five centuries of Ottoman Turkish rule, because these people are Muslim only because the Turks converted them. So for the Serbs, the Bosnians represent the living reminder of being slaves to the Turks for 4 or 5 centuries, because if had the Turks hadn't been there, there wouldn't be Muslims in the area in the first place.
The Muslims have been victims in the war in the Balkans. But a while ago, you wrote that when the cult of atheism ends in Yugoslavia, that Muslim violence against Orthodox Christians is a possibility. Do you think it could have gone either way?
Yes. What needs to be remembered is that Yugoslavia is a civil war. The Serbs are doing most of the oppressing because they have the numbers and they have the weapons. Had another one of these groups had the numbers and had the weapons, it's likely that they would now be seen as the bad guys in the eyes of the Western media. Though it is atmospherically similar to the Nazi Holocaust, it is different because these are atrocities that are happening within the maelstrom of civil war. It is not a premeditated policy of industrialized mass murder against an innocent people who have no weapons and no means to defend themselves. It's a little bit different.
Do you think that religious hostilities worsened under communism while they were suppressed?
Yes, precisely because they were suppressed. There was no outlet for them. The main crime of communism was that it kept people in an artificial and forced state of poverty for 4.5 decades, while the rest of Europe was becoming middle class. By denying people middle class culture, they denied them the security that goes with being middle class. I mean, people who own cars, washers, dryers, who are paying off mortgages, aren't likely to pick up assault rifles and start guerrilla warfare. If you doubt me, look at the difficulties between the Flemish-speaking Belgians and the French-speaking Belgians, or the French-speaking Canadians and the English Canadians. They have great difficulties between each other, but they are being fought out in boring parliamentary battles because middle-class people don't go to war. The true tragedy of the Balkans is that the communists denied people from becoming middle class.
So you think that if the people in the Balkans were more middle class, that they'd be arguing it out in Parliament?
If they were middle class, not more middle class.
Right, middle class
not just for 10 years, but for several generations. Mm-hmm. In Greece, you have the interesting situation where you have a culture that has been middle class for only one generation, and yet Greek nationalism now is stronger than it's ever been. One generation of middle class culture is not enough. You need several generations in order to sedate and tranquilize ethnic hatred so that they become manageable.
For years, you tried to get people interested in the coming crisis in the Balkans. Now that everybody's interested in the crisis in the Balkans, do you see a next place where ethnic conflict is about to break out?
Yes, it's interesting. I'm not a journalist. I'm a magazine writer more, and the trick in magazine writing is to write about stories before they become stories. What I'm starting next is a big project. I'm going to be going to Africa, to India, to Indonesia, and I'm going to be writing about environmental and demographic stress that is going to cause warfare in the 21st century, where population, soil depletion, things like that are going to get so out of control, they're going to hit critical mass, and they threaten the borders of most African and Asian countries, borders which may not exist in 20 years.
What about in the Balkans? Where do you see the conflict heading? You were telling me before the interview that you think it's all over for Bosnia.
Yes, I do. Bosnia cannot be reconstituted unless the international community is willing to send several hundred thousand troops to do that. I'm not sure that there's a willingness among the taxpayers of America or other West European states to do that. I think the most that could be done now is to keep the conflict from spreading, because Yugoslavia, Bosnia, whatever, is not going to be like Lebanon or like Northern Ireland, where it just continues, people continue to fight, but it drifts on to page 2 and page 3 because the novelty value of the war has worn off. This war, if it continues, it has to spread. It has to spread southward into Kosovo, Macedonia, threatening to draw Greece and Turkey into the conflict. It could spread northward and threaten to drag Hungary, Slovakia, and Romania in. And this is because of interlocking, chain-reacting ethnic hatreds. So what we have to do is to cauterize the conflict, to make sure that even if the fighting goes on in Bosnia, it does not spread. I've been one of those recommending sending a large peacekeeping force to Macedonia and Kosovo to keep it from spreading. Because what I fear is that because we lack the will to do anything bold and dramatic, we will be drawn into a kind of incrementalism, like in Vietnam, where we're doing airdrops now, 10,000 troops in 2 months, another 10,000 in 4 months, and they'll be diluted amidst the Bosnian countryside, where they'll be too many troops to be ignored, but too few to really do anything when the next round of ethnic cleansing gets started.
What do you think of the Vance and Owen peace plan?
The Vance-Owen peace plan is an awful peace plan, but there's nothing else out there in the moment. The only reason people are even taking it seriously is because nobody else is willing to get involved. This is an interesting situation, the Balkans, because everyone knows what needs to be done, but nobody wants to do it. So the result is we have a peace plan that's totally removed from any strategic or military logic that everybody is taking seriously, because nobody really wants to do anything, and the peace plan is a way of getting the United States and other countries off the hook.
When you say everybody knows what needs to be done, are you referring to the peacekeeping force?
No, I'm referring to what you have in the Balkans is a huge security hole that's tearing wider and wider and threatening to engulf other countries. The only way you plug a security hole is to send in force or to do something to redress the imbalance of force. The reason there's a security hole is because one side has too many weapons and is too willing to use it than the other side. The one way you cannot stop a situation like this is through negotiations. Negotiations have no role to play until the security imbalance is redressed.
What do you mean by a security hole?
A security hole is where nobody is in charge except for the side that has the most weapons and is willing to use those weapons. The Serbs know exactly what they want, and they're going for it. Everyone in Western Europe and America is talking, but the leaders in Serbia are willing to use force. Until somebody else is willing to credibly threaten force in the numbers required to slow down the Serbs, there will be a security vacuum.
What do you think of the food drop that the Clinton administration organized?
Somebody wrote in the papers, a pilot, that when you drop from 10,000 feet, the only thing you're sure of hitting is the earth. This is a political gesture because nobody wants to take risks. Much of the food will drop will land in the wrong hands. If you want it to land in the right hands, you have to risk your own soldiers' lives. The fact that we're dropping food, but at such a high altitude, shows that we're still treating the Balkans with benign neglect. We want to claim that we're doing something when in fact we're doing very little.
You think that the Pope should be doing something in Yugoslavia?
Yeah, I think the Vatican's policy in Yugoslavia has been indefensible. There is no place in the world where the Vatican has so many skeletons in its closet as it has in Croatia. And the real reason that the Pope has never traveled to Croatia, which is a Catholic country where Catholicism is every bit as deeply embedded as in Poland, and is right next door to Italy and less than an hour flying distance from Rome. Yet this Pope has never gone, yet he's gone to places in Africa, in the Far East, in the Pacific. He has not gone because the Vatican is ashamed of what it has done in Croatia throughout much of the 20th century. Its role, along with that of the Habsburg monarchs, in inspiring the Croats' hatred of the Greek Orthodox Serbs.
Robert Kaplan, where are you off to next?
I'm going to Turkey in April and to Azerbaijan for 2 months to do a story for National Geographic.
About?
About Turkey as an emerging power in the 21st century.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robert Kaplan is the author of the book Balkan Ghosts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.